The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Cosi. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Cosi starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Cosi.org.
Hey, I'm Steph.
I'm Alex.
And this is Not Today.
And we're live.
Hello.
How are you?
Fantastic. How are you?
I'm great. It's the weekend.
Sure is for us. I mean, when the episode comes out, it'll be Monday and Tuesday, depending on if you're on Patreon or not.
True.
But for us right now, it's Sunday.
But enjoying the weekend and excited for yet another story.
Yeah.
This one is a what?
A grain factory explosion.
It's new.
Kind of. We haven't talked about a grain factory or grain bins in quite some time. One of our earliest episodes was about a man who was in a grain bin and he fell into the corn and almost suffocated. So we've definitely talked about grain and industrial farming. Is that the right term?
Yeah.
You know,
farming
as a job.
Farming of grain.
Yeah. I didn't realize how dangerous farming actually was. Like, I knew it was a super dangerous job to have, but
I mean, you just don't think of it that way because just like growing stuff, you're like, oh, what are the plants going to get you?
Well, I mean,
it's all the machines.
Exactly. Yeah, there's so much heavy machinery. And also, like, even just the storage of it all. Like, the grain bin is a storage bin for all the grain. And people, like, fall in and suffocate. Like, that's a very big hazard for people. And we're going to talk about a different hazard having to do with these big grain silos in this episode. So learn something new every day. But anyway, before we jump in, as always, if you'd like some bonus content, head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. Our bonus episode will be coming out soon. We're going to be talking about Matthew and Shannon McGough. Matthew took his 5-year-old daughter, Shannon, on an overnight camping trip in the Australian outback, and the two became stranded in one of the most hostile places on Earth. So,
his 5-year-old?
Yes. So we're going to be talking about that over on Patreon. And yeah. Anyway, without further ado, why don't we get started on this week's episode?
All right. I'm excited for the wheat.
It was the morning of June 8th, 1998, near Wichita, Kansas, at the DeBruce Grain Elevator, a Bartlett Grain Company facility in Atchison. At the time of the accident, DeBruce Grain Elevator was the largest grain elevator in the world, being roughly half a mile in length, with a total of 310 grain storage silos.
What's a grain elevator?
So it's basically like this massive building that has a bunch of grain elevators, from what I understand. And it's basically like a cylinder where they keep all of the grain, and they have like an elevator that you can ride up and down to like go into different portions of the facility.
So like massive tubes in a building where the grain is, and then they can go up and down and poke at it from different levels.
Let me look up an actual definition before I say some stupid shit. Hang on. Yeah, so grain elevators are facilities that store, move, and process small dry cereal grains in bulk. They are the most common storage facilities for cereal grains and can also be used for drying and cleaning grain and loading it into transportation. Grain elevators use a belt and bucket conveyor system to lift grain and pour it into silos. The grain can then be dispensed from the bottom of the silos into trucks for transport. It's basically just like a big facility where they store and process the grain. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay,
it's
great.
It's a bunch of silos that grain goes in, grain comes out, baby.
Correct. At the time of the accident, DeBruce Grain Elevator was the largest grain elevator in the world, being roughly half a mile in length with a total of 310 grain storage silos. If it was storing wheat exclusively, it could supply the wheat for all the bread consumed in the U.S. for nearly 6 weeks. This one facility.
Wow.
June meant that it was almost harvest time in Kansas. Over the next 3 weeks, an entire season's wheat would be harvested and trucked to grain elevators for storage. Grain elevators are the largest man-made structures in the prairie states, and Kansas has a lot of them. But farm work is one of the most hazardous industries in America. Globally, at least 170,000 agricultural workers are fatally injured each year, while in the U.S., 60 to 70 farmers per 100,000 are killed annually. Non-fatal injuries affect around 33% of the farming population in the U.S., with 3% of accidents resulting in permanent disability.
Damn. I guess I never thought of or realized that.
Yeah, it's really dangerous work. Each year, more people die while farming than while serving as police officers, firefighters, or other emergency responders. They are more likely to die on the job than workers in any other profession. They're like 7 times more likely to die than people in other professions.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really crazy when you put the comparison like that.
You would think like a cop or someone who's like in search and rescue or some like intense job would have the highest mortality rate, but no, it's the farmers.
Yeah, I mean, it's I was thinking like the people who dive on oil rigs to clean them or shit like that. You're like underwater welding.
That is a scary job for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I just on its face, like farming wouldn't even make my top 10 if you asked me what are the top 10 most dangerous jobs.
Sure.
You know? Honestly, since I've gotten into gardening now, like it really makes me appreciate how much work goes into like one slice of bread.
Sure, yeah.
You know?
A lot.
And apparently death, like, yeah. And danger.
Yeah.
Crazy.
37-year-old Scott Mosteller worked at DeBruce Grain Elevator and loved the work. He and his close friends Lanny Owen and Johnny Sutton operated the elevator's nerve center. In the span of a few weeks, they would orchestrate the movement of more grain than many countries produce in a year. Inside the buildings were miles of conveyor belts and machinery that processes hundreds of thousands of bushels every hour. That machinery needed to be maintained meticulously, and for this harvest specifically, the workers were told it would be really big. So they needed to prepare the machinery for the very high volume of work they would have to use it for.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Elaine Caldwell, an accountant for DeBruce, arrived at work with her husband, Paul Caldwell. 65-year-old Howard Goen was also at work that day. He had retired the previous August, but came back for that year's harvest. He couldn't get enough of it.
Yeah, just a dedicated man.
Yeah. Beneath the silos, wheat was constantly moving. The underground network of conveyor belts stretched nearly a mile. Conveyor belts passed over roller bearings, and if even one of the 12,000 bearings in the complex seized up, it could overheat and cause a spark, and one spark in that environment could be deadly. When grain is handled at elevators, it creates dust that flows around inside the storage facility. The finer the grain dust particles, the greater the volatility. Grain dust is highly combustible. When it is suspended in the air, it can become explosive. Grain dust mixed in proper proportions with oxygen can be as explosive as dynamite, 8 times more volatile than gasoline.
What? Just dust?
Yeah. a single spark could ignite the grain dust, causing a catastrophic explosion. Typically, an explosion would happen due to sparks from the equipment or from a cigarette. So grain wow. factory explosions happen kind of frequently. Like, it's really dangerous. Wow. And dust from corn is among the most dangerous. Most...
Are you kidding?
Yeah. Most dust explosions happen in late summer and early fall when old dried grain is being cleaned out of the elevators in preparation for the harvest. Freshly harvested corn is less explosive because it's wetter.
Damn. It's like, okay, the number one crop we grow is the most combustible.
Right.
That's a kind of sick joke.
Seriously. Yeah.
And I mean, I'm sure they would have figured it out by now, but it's just crazy to me that there's no solution to this.
There is. I mean, it's obviously a hazard of the job, but you can make it happen less if you clean the machinery like really meticulously and also like very frequently. So there is steps you can take to make it less dangerous, but in places like this where there's so many things to clean and take care of, like it can be overlooked.
Right. I mean, it's half a mile of grain belt.
Yeah.
You know,
conveyor belt. Yeah. Over the past four decades, there have been more than 600 explosions at grain elevators, killing more than 250 people and injuring more than 1,000, according to the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. In grain elevators, danger is everywhere. Workers could be crushed by trucks or by freight trains. Massive machinery that is constantly moving can sever limbs or crush hands. Even getting to their posts can be dangerous. Some workers need to ascend a vertical conveyor belt that rises 200 feet. So it's basically like if you were going up 20 stories in an elevator, but there was no actual elevator. You just had this like tiny little platform to stand on in like an elevator shaft, essentially. So one wrong step and you could easily plunge to your death, because these little platforms that the workers stand on are not very big. It's like one person per platform. And they just step on it and it rises them all the way to the top. And then they step off of it when they get to where they need to go. So it's just like a person conveyor belt vertically. And it goes up 20 stories. Like, what? Wow. Johnny Sutton, Scott Mosteller, and Lanny Owen worked near the top of the head house, a 197-foot concrete tower between the silos. So like the building looks like this horizontal concrete thing of like silos and whatever. And then in the middle of the entire building is one really tall tower. So that's the head house. Howard Goen worked below in the underground tunnels that were 20 feet underground. Workers could reach different areas of the elevators by a series of catwalks and also the vertical conveyor belts. And this isn't a fancy place, so the tunnels underground were not air-conditioned, making them extremely hot during the spring and summer days, sitting around 100 degrees down there, just baseline.
Wow. Yeah, you're gonna need a lot of water.
Yeah, for sure. One of the scariest possibilities working in a place like this was fire, of course, because the whole place could go up very easily. To try to prevent that, workers had to check and grease thousands of bearings very regularly to make sure none of them overheated and ignited the explosive grain dust. Prior to the explosion that day, the South Gallery conveyor belts had just been cleaned, while the North Gallery had not. People in the DeBruce elevator before the explosion told investigators that the cloud of suspended grain dust was often so thick that during these times, one could not see their hand in front of their face.
Wow. And you know that it's just like essentially gas.
Kind of.
It's that combustible.
Yeah. And it's so fine. I mean, imagine breathing in a place like that.
Yeah. Do they get masks? Like,
I would hope.
Can't be good for the...
The lungs?
The old air pockets.
No.
You know?
Yeah, couldn't be good. At about 9:20 that morning, Howard Goen heard a sound that made his heart drop instantly. The sound he heard was from a bearing in an adjoining tunnel that had seized and overheated, igniting the grain dust.
I thought you were going to say the sound he heard was an explosion.
Well, he did, basically. He heard the grain dust igniting, which is an explosion, essentially. Ugh. So the initial blast set off a deadly chain reaction. The explosion kicked up more grain dust, which ignited, setting off even larger explosions. So once one explosion happens, it's kind of just a domino effect of like little explosions and bigger ones throughout the entire place. The men who were higher up in the headhouse tower heard a different sound, and then a 2,000-degree fireball shot up through their conveyor belt shaft. The flames shot through the opening where the men were working, and Scott Mosteller leapt to the floor and covered his face with his hands at the same time. So, I mean, picture like an action movie where the cool guy is walking away from the burning something and then it explodes behind him. So, and you know, an explosion happened into their room and he like jumped with his hands over his face away from the massive fireball coming at him. Fireballs are a common feature of grain dust explosions, where intense heat from the blast can reach 1,500 to 2,000 degrees. The explosion had traveled the length of the complex and blasted out of both ends. The dust had initially ignited in a tunnel and shot in both directions. The resulting explosions shot to the headhouse, and that extended up 190 feet and down into the ground. So it went all the way up and then all the way down the headhouse, and from there, the blast wave shot in both directions through the north and south galleries. A trucker outside, who was there to pick up the first load of grain, heard the muffled blasts and then saw the explosions blowing apart the structure that he had parked in front of. Pieces of the building flew at his windshield and shattered it, almost blinding this man, and definitely could have killed him because chunks of concrete were coming out his vehicle kind of like projectiles at this point. The explosion was so loud it could be heard from 15 miles away. The ground shook so hard that the blast was felt into Missouri. Paul Macchia, who lives about half a mile from the grain elevator, said the explosion shook his house and lights flickered across his neighborhood for about 30 seconds as it was happening. Sedgwick County dispatcher Vanessa Downey was on duty that morning and got the first few calls about the explosion. It had been a pretty quiet day. She was getting calls about normal things like car stops, but then all of a sudden her day took a drastic turn. She got a call from a man who called in the explosion saying, oh my God, it's so big. He couldn't tell her exactly what had happened, but the grain elevator had exploded and it was really bad. From that moment on, the emergency line was flooded with calls. They received about 110 phone calls within the first half an hour, which only continued. The calls initially were about the explosion, but then turned into calls of panic about specific people who were missing or potentially trapped. Sedgwick County Fire Chief Gary Kermode took the call from dispatch, and six fire stations and two rescue teams responded to the emergency. But even with that amount of response, nothing could prepare them for the amount of devastation that had taken place. When firefighters arrived, the area looked like a war zone. Huge sections of the structure were in ruins, the fires continued to burn, and the concrete was full of massive cracks that had broken apart. Lieutenant John Troyer was one of the first on the scene and said, quote, "When the elevator first came into view, it was an amazing sight. You could tell there were large sections that were blown away. There was smoke rising like crazy. I couldn't believe that there was that much destruction on that elevator, and I turned to my lieutenant and said, 'We're going to be here a very, very long time.'" Things were a lot more chaotic than they should have been. In a place where catastrophic explosions are a possibility, there needed to be a lot more planning and organization in place. DeBruce Grain Emergency Action Plan did exist, but according to OSHA, it, quote, "existed only on paper and had neither been described to nor rehearsed with the workers."
Well, that's very helpful.
Right. It's like if you have a place that could explode at any moment, you should probably have some rock solid plans.
What year is this?
1998.
Yeah. Okay, so this is like, you know, we're not talking about like 1920.
No, definitely not. Right, like you think by then they would have figured something out.
Yeah,
but
I mean,
I guess not.
Yeah, I think they're going to get sued.
I would
and
hope.
They should be.
Yeah, seriously. Investigators also said there was an absence of documented work assignments, which made it difficult to know where the workers would be in the building. So not only did they not have like a proper plan for the workers, but they didn't know where the workers were in the building. At the time of the accident, there were 20 workers on property, 11 working for the DeBruce Grain Company, 9 working for Labor Source Incorporated, 3 working for Industrial Maintenance Incorporated, 2 for Dunsbury Trucking, and 1 for Lange Company, and 1 working for Rob Hireman Trucking. So there were a lot of different people on the premises, not necessarily all with DeBruce, but still, it was chaotic. First responders arrived at DeBruce Grain within 10 minutes of the explosion, but they had trouble finding out how many people were in the structure and where they should even start looking for them. There were many challenges because of the immense size of the elevator and limited access to some of the damaged areas. Yeah, I mean, think about a half a mile long.
Yeah, I mean, how many people do they have? Like, maybe 30? Said it was like 6 fire trucks. I mean, it's less than 50 probably, and you have a half mile
to
of
cover.
Structure to cover.
Yeah.
The whole thing go up?
Pretty much, yeah. It came out of both sides of the building.
Wow, no wonder they heard it 15 miles away.
Yeah.
Could you imagine a half mile of dynamite?
Yeah, pure explosion.
Yeah.
No, that sounds terrifying. And it was. Inside the destroyed building, workers who survived the blast had to dig themselves out from the smoldering rubble. Elaine Caldwell suffered bruises, lacerations, and burns, but was more worried about her husband, who was working at the top of the silo. She made her way through the wreckage and was stunned by what she saw. Parts of the building were still on fire, walls were blown apart, and other injured workers who were burned and bloody were staggering out from where they were thrown. Elaine helped them, but the room that she had just come from was unrecognizable. It had filled with smoke, flames, chunks of concrete, and twisted metal. The emergency responders saw people running around, people in shock, but one of the most concerning sights was the concrete and rebar that was hanging off of the silos, because they were very worried that this structure could just collapse in on itself. To make matters worse, they had about 40 to 60 mile an hour winds to deal with.
What?
I don't know why. I mean, I guess it's Kansas, so you're in like twister territory,
what?
Right? But I don't think a tornado was necessarily like on the radar. I think they just had really high winds.
That's insane though. That's pretty close to like tropical storm speeds.
Yeah. It was a bad time for an explosion.
Yeah, no shit. Try and put that fire out. You're just pumping oxygen into everywhere.
I know. Yeah.
And it's underground too.
Mm-hmm.
So the ground's also on fire?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh my God.
The head house where they believed the initial blast had occurred was moving in the wind. Because this is like a very tall tower that has now been blown apart. Like chunks of concrete are missing from this structure. So it's like swaying in the wind. And they're like, how do we even approach this safely? You know, like as the rescue workers, they didn't even know, one, where to start, where to find the people, but also how they could even get in there themselves without also just being crushed or killed by the structure.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Probably you don't.
They had to do something. Even as the rescue workers were trying to fight the fires and get people out, grain continued to burst into flames and debris fell around them. So there's still explosions happening and like more fire that's catching onto grain. The problem was that the south grain gallery dust had just been cleaned, so the fires in that area went out, but the north gallery explosions continued into these empty silos down in the basement, where it again went several directions, including north to the exit. As the explosions traveled underneath these silos, they also rose through the silos and blew off many of the silos' tops. So the entire north side of the building is like continuing to explode and like the tops of things are blowing off. Like the roof is just blowing off from these explosions. So after evaluating the risk, Chief Kermode coordinated rescue operations. Firefighters learned that several men were trapped in tunnels 20 feet underground. So rescue missions needed to be divided into several different areas. They also set up a triage area for the people who managed to make it out themselves, because people were walking around just covered in burns and wounds. So they set up a triage area. They sorted the patients by severity, those who needed help immediately, all the way to those who were mostly fine and didn't really need help. In the head house, Johnny Sutton was very badly burned. The room was filled with smoke and he was surrounded by rubble, but he managed to pull out his radio to give his position. He said he was in the head house and they were going to try to get out. A coworker who had escaped with minor injuries heard his transmission. After that, Sutton tried to help dig out Lanny Owens, who was in very bad shape. The walls around them shook and swayed in the wind. 18-inch slabs of concrete had been pulverized. Scott Mosteller had been blown to the back wall of the scale office, which had also been destroyed, which was like the very top of the head house. Looking around, Scott was surprised that he was still alive. When an explosion like this happens, the top part of the headhouse could be blown away completely or collapse. So from the time the explosion happened, Scott Mosteller thought that this was it for him. He felt pain over his entire body as he tried to make his way through the rubble. He had never gone through anything like that before, so he was afraid that he would pass out or go into shock before he could be rescued. He knew there was no way he would make it down and out of the building, so he decided his best bet was to go up to the roof.
So the top of it blew off, or at least partially, but he is at the top in the office, and now he's climbing up?
Yeah, so the office that they were in was like near the top of the headhouse, but there was still like a little bit above them, and the roof hadn't completely blown off of the headhouse. The tops had blown off the silos, some of them, but like explosions had occurred and like the building was blown apart, but like there was still a roof.
Okay.
Yeah.
And there's still wind.
There is still wind.
A lot of that.
Yes.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. Funny thing about being fast, you end up waiting a lot. First to show up, first in line, then just waiting. Me, I rev up Chumba Casino. With over 200 social casino games, no slow lanes here. Why sit around when you can spin? I'm already racing. Your turn. Play for free at ChumbaCasino.com. That's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Scott couldn't find his friends, and as he made his way up the structure, he had to cross over mangled catwalks and collapsing sections of the concrete floor. He had to jump over openings in the floor so he wouldn't fall through and plummet to his death. When he made it to the rooftop, he could hear sirens coming from miles around. Johnny Sutton had managed to help Lanny Owens up and over to a spot where they wouldn't be crushed by falling concrete or machinery. Meanwhile, Elaine Caldwell pleaded with firefighters to find her husband, who would have been on top of the massive complex. And she was correct, because at the south end, Paul Caldwell lay injured by himself. Firefighters had to figure out how to rescue these stranded workers, but the buildings they were in looked close to collapsing. Among the first relatives to hear about the blast was Tom Mosteller, whose son, Scott Mosteller, was stranded at the top of the headhouse. The explosion had blown his hard hat off and his walkie-talkie off, but he had his cell phone inside his coveralls, meaning Scott Mosteller. He didn't call his father until he got out to the top, but once he did call, he told his father he was badly burned, but that rescue workers had arrived. By mid-morning, firefighters from Nebraska and Oklahoma had arrived to help fight the fires and rescue people. Roads were blocked with crowded relatives who were trying to get to the scene. Sedgwick County deputies had to stop them all at a roadblock and did their best to keep them contained and informed, but at the same time, more and more people began showing up because this explosion absolutely rocked everyone around from a 15-mile radius. So even if they didn't have family members, they were like, let's go see this, you know?
Oh.
I mean, probably not even just from like a, this is going to be cool, but like,
can we help?
Yeah, can we help? And like, oh my God, I can't believe this happened.
Right.
You know? Authorities knew they needed to set up a place where family members could gather to wait for the news. So rescue workers directed them to a nearby elementary school that many of the workers' children attended. Family members all gathered around a television in that school to watch the broadcast, and rescue personnel updated them every hour, but the news was grim. Firefighters quickly found the bodies of two men who had been killed in the blast. One of the victims' clothes had been almost completely blown off. Bill Acterlony, one of the EMTs who was helping to treat the injured workers, saw that so many people had severe burns that needed treatment immediately. EMTs put sterile sheets over people's bodies and poured saline solution on top of them, I guess as a way to keep them clean or to hydrate their wounds. I'm not entirely sure because I'm not an EMT, but they were doing that to help people, I guess, in the interim between the hospital and the scene, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay. Rescue workers soon learned the number of men that were at the elevator at the time of the blast. Sections of the massive structure were destroyed or continuing to collapse as the fires continued. Piles of wheat were still spontaneously bursting into flames. Tom Mosteller had managed to get through to the scene and told firefighters that he had spoken to his son on his cell phone. Because remember, all the families were being sent to the elementary school, but Tom Mosteller, who is Scott Mosteller's dad, got through to the scene to like where the firefighters were and was like, my son has a cell phone and he's talking to me about what's happening on the roof, which was really good information.
Great information. And I love just barging in.
Yeah, right?
Definitely do that.
Ask for forgiveness, not permission or something. Tom told them his son had been badly burned and was stranded at the top of the head house. Johnny Sutton, who had gotten through to the workers on his walkie-talkie, told them that he and Lanny Owen were both very badly burned and trapped near the rooftop, near the scale office, and that he could hear someone above them. Firefighters knew there were at least four survivors trapped in this concrete tower between the silos. None of the fire departments who had been on the scene from Kansas, Nebraska, or Oklahoma had ladders long enough to reach the top of the structure. So medical rescue organizations and media outlets offered choppers, but Kermode knew that those wouldn't help. Helicopters typically in rescue situations are useful, but they have to be designed for the rescue situation. So the rescue workers were offered a life watch and an Eagle Med helicopter, but the problem was that they weren't designed to rescue people off of buildings, so it wasn't going to really work.
Yeah, also it's incredibly windy. I mean, I don't even know if they could operate in 60 mile an hour winds.
Yeah, I don't know. It definitely would have been sketchy.
Yeah, I don't think it would make it easier.
Right. So desperate, workers sought help from the Army Medical Unit at Fort Riley, Kansas, and that unit dispatched their rescue helicopter. At the burn center in the nearby hospital, nurses and doctors anxiously awaited all of the victims of the blast. They had to just stand around monitoring the news to know what was going on and just prepare for the worst. It was kind of the calm before the storm. The fireballs that had occurred had scorched victims' exposed skin instantaneously, so they were going to be dealing with some really intense burns, which can be very life-threatening fast. It wasn't just the life-threatening burns, they also had terrible injuries from the explosion. Survivors were covered in gashes and bruises from flying debris. At 11:30, a combat rescue helicopter from Fort Riley's 82nd Medical Company arrived to help to get stranded workers. They scanned the quarter-mile-long complex looking for survivors. Paul Caldwell, who was alone at the far end of the complex, waved desperately to attract their attention. And finally, they spotted him, but as you mentioned, the wind was still very strong. It made their rescue extremely treacherous. They were going to lower a medic to grab Paul and basically pull him up, but under normal conditions, a helicopter rescue like that requires a tremendous amount of skill and coordination, but in that wind, it was like you would have to be damn near the best helicopter pilot to pull it off. Because if the pilot didn't maintain a steady altitude and position, the medic could slam into the structure with enough force to kill him. So it's like you're risking not only the person who's stranded and like being left up there, but the medic who's going to try to grab him could potentially get thrown into something and also die.
Yeah, he's essentially a wrecking ball.
Yeah.
On the way down.
Yeah, kind of. The prop wash, or the wind created by the helicopter propeller, was also scary because it could have picked up chunks of concrete and metal and turned them into projectiles as well.
Wait, what? What? Huh?
So I guess the propeller, like the wind that that causes, was it had enough force to like pick up concrete and throw it, because there were like chunks of concrete.
Oh, okay. You mean like downward toward people?
Just around.
Not up.
Yeah, I guess not up at them, but just around at other people.
Cool.
Okay.
I was like, oh, how the fuck does it do that?
Yeah.
We have a medic coming down as a wrecking ball and also possible more chunks of debris.
Yes. Perfect, right?
What could possibly go wrong?
Right.
I mean, it's these people's only shot.
Yeah. No, it really is. There were so many people that needed rescuing. So the people on the roof, I mean, at least Paul Caldwell, they're like, if we can see him and we can get him, we're going to try to do that. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, it's an army helicopter pilot.
Yeah.
Well, probably pretty close to the best of the best.
Yeah,
no?
Totally. Thankfully, the rescue team was able to get Paul Caldwell with the helicopter. He was critically injured, but he was alive. But other badly injured workers remained stranded on the rooftops. The Fort Riley soldiers also spotted Johnny Sutton and Lanny Owen, but as they descended closer, the prop wash caused the concrete walls to sway and crack, and so they basically had to abort mission and not rescue them.
Damn. Also, you were describing how difficult the rescue would be, and then you were like, and then he rescued them.
And then they did it.
And then they did it.
Yeah.
And I'm just trying to imagine how that actually happened. Like, probably took like at least 10 minutes.
Yeah, I assume. Know. Yeah.
And it's just like the wind is going and he's just trying to not become death by wrecking ball, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, they had to slowly lower this like rescue person down as the wind is flailing. No, that's not the right word.
just
going.
Screaming.
Yeah, screaming. And then, you know, he picked him up and had to then pull them back up toward the helicopter with all of the wind, not just the natural wind, but also the propeller wind that is causing concrete projectiles.
Yeah. I mean, I know we have to do this for the story, but it's such a crazy experience to sum up in one sentence.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Right. And so Johnny Sutton, who was hoping to be rescued by this helicopter, who then had to abort mission, also was like waving them off because he, who is like surrounded by this crazy rubble and everything, sees the building start to sway and crack. And he's like, no, go away, like leave. Do not rescue me because it's not worth it, kind of thing. Not that he doesn't want to be rescued, but that it's like obviously too dangerous to do what right. they were doing. They had to have another operation to get him. So the four men near the scale office in the head house would be the most difficult to rescue. They were in contact with the rescue team by walkie-talkie, but as time went on, they could tell that the men were becoming weaker and weaker. Firefighters had to figure out a way to reach those men before time ran out. They managed to track down a 175-foot crane that was being used to move equipment at a nearby power plant. But it had to be brought there. So as time went by, the firefighters feared that by the time it arrived, it would be too late. When it did finally arrive, Sedgwick County Fire Lieutenant John Troyer said they had to move rail cars to get the crane in place, and they needed to set it up and, like, I guess weigh it down, which was not an easy thing to do because it was so massive. They also had to get a crew in place and brief them on what needed to happen, which was a lot of moving parts. To get them to the top of the building took a very long time. Rescuers who had been down below in the bowels of the grain elevator were also facing a nightmare situation. Four men were trapped in the tunnels 20 feet below the ground, and rescuers needed to figure out how to get down there and get them out. The tunnels were well over 100 degrees, remember, at the start, before the massive fires and explosion. And they were pitch black and so choked with smoke and grain dust that breathing filters clogged in minutes. So these rescue workers are like, how the hell are we going to get these people that are trapped in the tunnels? Because it's so hot, we cannot breathe and we cannot see.
Get creative, I guess.
I don't even know. At any moment, they also knew that if grain dust ignited, it would kill everyone inside. And that was a very real possibility. Also, the tunnels were built to withstand the pressure of millions of tons of concrete above it, but now the tunnels creaked and groaned as if they might give way, crushing everyone inside. Even a minor collapse would trap the rescue workers. So a dog from Kansas Search and Rescue was enlisted to help find the men in this massive complex. A rescue worker went down with the dog to do the canine search. And that was off to a very ominous start, because the trained search dogs communicate with their handlers with distinctive barks, and the dog had signaled that he found human remains beneath a pile of smoldering rubble. So things were not looking good down there. In the head house, survivors worried that rescuers might not be able to reach them soon enough either. During the blast, Scott Mosteller had covered his face with his hands, which was a very good move because his hands were so badly burned that his skin was charred. So if he didn't put his hands over his face would have been charred.
Oh, yeah.
But still, he was in terrible shape. And Scott knew that because his hands didn't feel hot. They felt ice cold.
That's not good.
That's a terrible sign. Tom Mosteller, his father, who had been in touch with Scott, knew his son was showing classic signs of shock. That was very bad because shock is a prime killer of burn victims. Scott told his father he was very cold and wanted to go to sleep, so Tom told him he couldn't go to sleep because they needed to communicate to find out where they were trapped and any other information about their situation, like how the other guys were doing. So Tom told Scott not to go to sleep, and he would continue calling him to make sure that he was awake. So I guess he's just not trying to freak him out and say, hey, if you fall asleep, you probably won't wake up. So he's like, we have to keep up with the information, and you have to give us, you know, updates on the other guys.
See, I wouldn't be able to do that.
No.
I'd be like, listen here, bitch.
You stay
awake
right now.
You're going to die if you stop. If you go to sleep.
Yeah.
So I'd be just screaming at him.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, people react differently in stressful life or death situations. So.
Yeah, I know. This is not me.
No. Yeah. I don't know how anyone could do it. But
this is calm in the storm.
Yeah. Johnny Sutton feared that he and Lanny Owens wouldn't make it much longer. Lanny was in terrible shape. When the explosion hit, he had been looking down and his face took the full force of the 2,000 degree fireball. At the base of the elevator, rescuers worked tirelessly to clear any debris they could and anchored the huge outriggers that would keep the crane from tipping over. But finally, they were ready to hoist the crane up to where they could get in. It brought them up more than 130 feet while the crane arm rocked in the gusting wind, which sounds terrifying. And as we know, the massive concrete headhouse tower was almost destroyed. The walls were made of 18-inch concrete with 1-inch reinforced rebar every 6 inches, and it was almost completely blown away. There were huge holes in the floors of the headhouse elevator, and the amount of destruction was just amazing. There was almost nothing left. So making their way through that was incredibly dangerous. Moving even 20 feet through the building put the lives of the rescuers in jeopardy. Nothing was stable, and the winds made the structure rock. By the time the men reached Sutton and Owen, they were extremely weak and in agonizing pain. Every part of their exposed skin had been burned to the third degree, and they most likely had inhalation burns, which are very, very dangerous. The rescuers had to get them out of there as quickly as possible while still being safe themselves, which was a very delicate balance. And the wind had picked up. If the rescuers took even one wrong step, they would plunge more than 100 feet into the fire that was still burning below. It's like you're looking down into the depths of hell.
Oh, yeah. And this whole time, you were saying, like, explosions are still happening.
Yeah.
Fires are still raging.
Yes.
It's just
a nightmare?
Yeah.
Yeah. And they had to carry out these men who were, like, extremely weak at this point because this whole rescue operation had taken hours, like, probably almost the entire day. They clutched Johnny Sutton and Lanny Owen as they moved methodically back to the crane. All they could do was hope that they reached the men in time. Tom Mosteller did continue to call his son to make sure he was awake and fill him in on the details of the rescue progress. The men had been stranded for hours at that point. Scott's hands were trembling, and he grew increasingly sleepy. Tom assured his son rescue was on the way and that Scott had to hang on, but the crane was still several floors below Scott. Rescuers had to scale part of the destroyed headhouse tower just to reach him. Scott was terrified that if he fell asleep, he would never wake up. He tried to occupy his mind with anything that would keep him awake. He looked to see if his Jeep had been hit with any concrete to take his mind off of it a little bit. So I guess he was able to like look down to the parking lot and was like checking on his Jeep, because that was the only thing he could do to not think about, hey, if I fall asleep, I'll probably die.
Yeah, I mean, think about, hey, at least the Jeep isn't totaled.
Right, yeah. From the command post below, Tom Mosteller and the firefighters spotted the rescuers emerging on the rooftop where Scott was. They were able to get him off of the roof by carrying him, but to get him down to the crane basket, firefighters had to use ropes and gear designed to rescue mountain climbers to lower him down. So they're basically using like ropes and pulling, like a pulley system, to put him into the crane. His burns were excruciating, and the climbing ropes tore into his charred skin because, ooh, you know, his skin is really,
not there.
Yeah, it's really weak, and these ropes are tight. All of the men's burns were so crusted with soot and debris, which increased the chance of lethal infections. A medevac chopper was immediately dispatched and was waiting on the ground for Scott. When he finally got on the ground, he was immediately loaded into the helicopter and flown to the nearest hospital. All three men had lost massive amounts of fluid through their burns and were in very bad shape. But once at the hospital, their fight for survival had really only begun. Lanny Owen, Scott Mosteller, and Johnny Sutton were in critical condition.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
Burn nurse Rhonda Young was part of their treatment team and said that the swelling that occurs after the burns were compromising their airways, so they needed to deal with that immediately. I didn't even think of that as being a possibility. Like, after you're burnt like that, you swell, and then it was closing up their airways.
Yeah, I didn't think it. Well, if you have inhalation burns, I guess that's where it swells.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, but definitely not. I mean, I don't even know how you treat burns, but I know that it's very, very delicate.
It
seems like, you know, from somebody who doesn't, I'm not a doctor, It just seems like, oh, you got out of the fire, like you should be fine. But
right.
Actually, like the worst part is yet to come.
Yeah, that's very true. They also had to keep the men from dying of shock, dehydration, and infection, which are all very swift killers when it comes to burns. And still at the scene, there were multiple people trapped and unaccounted for. The rescuers were still down in the tunnels trying to figure out how to get trapped people out safely and also how to just locate them, because at this point they don't know where the hell anyone is. The tunnels were clogged with wheat, mangled chunks of metal and concrete, and the wheat itself was one of the biggest danger. Not just because it was flammable, but the massive amounts of wheat can engulf a man like quicksand, which can suffocate someone very quickly, which we have talked about in the past. So I guess they're like looking through these massive silos, and if they weren't careful, then they would just get sucked into the wheat and suffocate.
It's just like the last thing that you think of when you think of, oh, we need to store wheat.
Yeah,
it's a death trap.
It'll also become quicksand, by the way.
Yeah.
And it produces nitrogen dioxide or silo gas, which is what they call it, and that can kill you in minutes.
Cool.
It's like, what part of this can't kill you in minutes? Like, it's just...
Yeah, and I'm like...
Unbelievable.
How bad do we need bread, you know?
Pretty bad. I mean
you know, we gotta live, but, you know, I mean, the next time I put my hand on a loaf of bread at the store, I'm gonna think a lot differently.
That's true.
I'd be like, oh... The burns.
Oof.
You know.
I mean, you know, this happened
a long
time ago.
I'll try not to. I know, it happened, whatever. But, you know, Who knew that wheat was so fucking dangerous?
Yeah, seriously. Although fires were still burning throughout the complex, they tried to remain hopeful after one of them reported hearing screaming and banging on a pipe, which meant someone was alive down there. As the search intensified, Sedgwick County officials desperately needed help, and that evening the site was declared a national emergency. FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Administration, dispatched a search and rescue team from Lincoln, Nebraska. The team included rescue specialists, physicians, structural engineers, dog team handlers, and more paramedics. But they were working against time. If the workers trapped had found air pockets in the mounds of wheat, they would only have a limited supply of oxygen. Throughout the night, searchers combed the tunnels for any signs of life, but the structure was so unstable they couldn't get to every area that they wanted to. FEMA brought state-of-the-art search and rescue gear, including infrared cameras and super-sensitive listening devices. Using a slender pole-mounted camera, they searched beyond narrow crevices and mounds of wheat. Operators manipulated the camera with a joystick, watching on a small TV monitor. They found air pockets, but no signs of survivors. The tunnels were massive, dark, and smoky. Debris made more than three-quarters of them inaccessible. To conduct a thorough enough search, they would have had to get the grain out. So structural engineers devised a way to keep grain from funneling down the damaged silos, and to stop the flow of wheat, they pushed sheets of plywood against the ceiling, blocking the silos' mangled release doors. 6-inch timbers held the plywood in place like vertical beams in a mineshaft. And then they had to clear the wheat using shovels and a massive vacuum truck. So,
just sucking it all up.
Yeah, but, first, they had to plug up the doors with plywood and, wooden beams. Otherwise, it could just all come flooding out and, suffocate people. But they did manage to clear hundreds of yards and reach parts of the tunnel that they hadn't searched. Although hope was beginning to fade as rescuers uncovered the remains of one of the workers and later found two more bodies. The explosion had killed the workers instantly, and they were not able to be identified, at least at that time, which is obviously extremely devastating, but part of me wants to say that at least they didn't suffocate and suffer, it was instantaneous.
Yeah.
But it's horrifying. Families waited for the DNA test results, hoping their loved ones weren't among the bodies that were found. One by one, they were given their news. Either they had been found or they were killed. The last man missing was 65-year-old Howard Goen, who had worked at the elevator for 42 years. As they searched for him, Chief Kermode became very worried the search was becoming too dangerous and they would lose one of their own. Also, since it was so hot down there, firefighters could only work in those conditions for an hour at a time. The amount of damage they had discovered in the recently cleared tunnels made them believe that it was highly unlikely anyone would have survived the blast. Falling debris and collapses put searchers in constant danger. Investigators began to trace the path of the explosion. Although the elevator was filled with rubble, they were able to reconstruct the blast by examining scorch patterns and trace the trajectory of concrete that hung from rebar or was blasted into open fields. The investigators' initial findings confirmed what the rescue workers feared. The first explosion occurred in one of the tunnels where a seized bearing overheated, igniting the grain dust. Within moments, a fireball blasted through the south tunnels, blowing out either end, and the explosion shot up the headhouse tower with astonishing force. Small explosions ignited more dust and transformed the metal doors and conveyor belts into shrapnel. A steel door from the bottom floor was tightly wrapped around a girder more than 100 feet high. The explosions traveled across the top of the structure, shaking dust and then igniting it, transforming silos into 130-foot-tall concrete rifle barrels. The silos were just kind of turned into just...
rockets?
What's it called?
Cannon?
A cannon, yeah. I had no idea that grain dust could become flammable like that. Unfortunately, formal rescue efforts were aborted, and they went into recovery mode, which was something they did not do lightly. On Friday, June 19th, 11 days after the explosion, Lanny Owen died from his injuries in the hospital. Several weeks after the explosions, Howard Goen's body was found. Doctors were concerned that with the state of the burns on Scott Mosteller's hands, he would lose fingers or the use of his hands. But they did skin grafts for the area of his hands that had third-degree burns, and they gave him massive amounts of antibiotics to fight off infection. And it took months for these survivors to recover. Scott was unable to return to his job at the elevator, but he did return to work at the hospital that saved his life.
That's really cool.
Yeah. Firefighters had to remain at the elevator for over a month, extinguishing grain that continued to burn.
For a month?
For a month. It was one of the biggest catastrophes they had ever experienced. It was rated 6 out of 10 of the worst explosions in the world due to the size of the structure, the economy, and the cost factors.
I mean, that's baffling.
I know.
Number 6?
Mm-hmm. In the world.
I don't know. You would think it'd be at like a chemical plant or like an oil refinery, you know?
Yeah.
Jesus.
But I guess if what you're working with is flammable enough.
Yeah.
The Occupational Safety and Health Administration found that there was too much grain dust on the day of the explosion and the dust collection systems were not working. Investigators said some systems had been down for over a year.
What? How did they not know that?
I don't know if they didn't know or they just didn't necessarily care to be swift about fixing it.
Well, I would say that swift would be a couple weeks and
right.
slowly would be a couple months.
Right.
But not at all would be at least a year.
Yeah. I don't know. It's possible they didn't know. But I feel like for a place like that where you have to be so meticulous with like cleaning and upkeep, that would be something you would check on. But it seems like there weren't safety measures in place. Like they had it on paper in some ways, but like actually doing them was not really happening, it seems.
Yeah. I mean, I'm hope that this was turned into a case study for, you know, what not to do and improving protocol.
Yeah, it was. There was a lot of change that happened because of this. So this is one of those moments where it's like a catastrophe happens and it's awful and tragic and, you know, so many terrible things happened, but a lot of change happened as a result.
Well, at least there's that.
Yeah. The explosion ultimately killed 7 men who worked for either DeBruce or Labor Source Incorporated, and 10 men were injured, which honestly, thinking about the scale of things, is not that many.
Yeah, if it's number 6 in the world as far as scale, the fact that only 17 people were killed or injured is kind of astonishing.
It is, yeah. I mean, obviously, no one should have been killed. There should have been so many other measures in place to prevent this from happening. But yeah, I mean, for the scale of it, it is kind of good that not more than that died.
Yeah.
Because it was a big plant. It was really big.
Right. It burned for a month after.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, think about that.
Right.
How long a month is.
Yeah.
And how many, I mean, you said there was like 320, it was a half mile.
Yeah.
Of what essentially turned into explosives.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I guess just given that scale, 17 seems small.
Yeah, in a way, it does.
But it's still incredibly tragic.
Yeah, of course. The disaster led to significant changes to safety practices in agriculture in the U.S. and led to the creation of OSHA's Grain Elevator Explosion Investigation Team. And that investigation team handled the investigation into DeBruce grain explosion. The team arrived 2 weeks after the disaster. The team did an extensive investigation. They also interviewed the injured and uninjured workers, plus people who had been around the elevator before the blast. They also talked to 3 people who heard the explosions. One person about half a mile away was outside when he heard the loud explosion. He turned toward the elevator and saw black smoke at ground level. He saw a fireball shoot out of the side and above the headhouse a split second later. He said it shot up about twice the height of the headhouse, approximately 500 feet in the air. Another person who was in his home, about 7.5 miles from the elevator, heard a series of at least 5 explosions and said the blast woke his 18-year-old son. I mean, that's a kind of a silly detail, I guess, but like, yeah, it woke you up. It was a loud explosion. I'm sorry.
Woke my son up.
It woke
up. He had school the next day.
What was it? 9 in the morning. So.
Oh, well.
Anyway, that was a silly detail.
Slept in. Just keeping. I don't even know.
Anyway, OSHA blamed DeBruce for deliberate corporate decisions. The investigator said DeBruce allowed massive amounts of fuel to continually be created and distributed throughout the elevator, delaying repairing grain dust control systems and abandoned preventative maintenance of equipment. In February of 2001, DeBruce agreed to pay $685,000 in fines while admitting no fault.
Well, they always do that. Typical. That's the plea deal, though,
yeah,
right?
That is typical.
So who does that money go to?
I think it was like for the people who were injured and the families, I'm assuming.
685?
Yeah.
That's pennies.
Yeah.
That's chump change. I'm sorry.
No, like, for a company that big, like...
Well, for 7 lives, for 10 people that were injured, how much were their medical bills?
Yeah. No, you're totally right.
At least, I mean, think about lost wages. Think about emotional distress. Like,
yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm becoming a lawyer now. I'm selling this hard, but I don't know. 685... If it was truly explicit negligence, mm-hmm. and you killed people because of it, you're going to not even give each person that's dead $100,000. Like,
that's true. Yeah, I didn't even think about it that way.
Like, okay, your husband died. Here's, it's not probably not even $90,000 because it's going to everyone who was affected.
Yeah.
Here's $50,000.
Jeez, yeah.
Your husband died.
Right. That's.
Here's $50,000. Your wife died. Here's 50, your mom died. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like. I don't know.
No, it's so fucked
up. I think
up.
They should have criminal charges.
Yeah, they definitely should have had to take fault and like have a bigger payout, of course, but that's not what happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pisses me off.
I know, me too.
Like, I don't even know. Can executives like that be criminally charged with criminal negligence? Like,
I mean, it would depend.
I would have to look that up.
Yeah.
Because... I don't know. It seems like such a common, repeated pattern.
Yeah.
If you purposely make a decision that kills people, I think that you should go to jail.
Sure. Yeah. Especially if you're knowing that what you're doing could potentially lead to catastrophic injury or death.
Yeah. I don't know. Because it's just like, if I'm an executive, how much did they save not repairing that?
I have no idea. The cost was of the machine? I don't know.
I don't know. At that scale, probably a good chunk of money.
Yeah.
And they only had to pay out less than $700,000.
Yeah.
Like, you could look at it like a business decision that was worth it.
God, that's disgusting.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, this is where, I don't know. This is why I'm like, there has to be some other punishment. Like, this does not match the crime.
No, I totally agree.
It does not dissuade people from doing this again. Yeah. I don't think.
Yeah, you're right. It's fucked up. Since the DeBruce explosion, there has been a heightened focus on improving safety standards in the grain industry. Facilities are now more vigilant in implementing dust control measures and adhering to safety regulations. And OSHA has expanded its inspections and efforts to control volatile grain dust in Kansas elevators since the explosion. And I hope just grain elevators everywhere, not just in Kansas. I don't know exactly where they're located, but I'm assuming they're not just in Kansas. And now the company is owned by Viterra, the new name for Gavilon, which bought DeBruce in 2010. I don't know if I'm pronouncing those correctly.
Who cares?
I'm
Nobody
not an
knows,
expert in grain
you know?
Companies, I guess. But
yeah, faceless it, company A.
Seriously, yeah. But DeBruce is now no longer the owner of, or I don't know, you know, whoever owned it before is now gone.
Right.
Anyway, that is the explosion. And it's unbelievable to me. I mean, so many parts of this story were shocking and just like I was completely not on my radar as far as like what I would have expected to happen. I don't know. Like when I hear like an explosion in a factory, I'm thinking like a machine blew up or something. I'm not thinking like the thing that you're processing throughout the entire plant that's a half a mile long and like 20 stories high in some portions of it. Can explode and cause a fireball that's 20,000 degrees or whatever and shoots 500 feet in the air. Like, that just does not, that does not sound real.
No. It's wheat, you know? It's just, like, the most common thing that we've eaten for, I don't know, as long as humans have been around.
Like, bread.
Bread, dude. Yeah. I'm also shocked and so surprised by how volatile it is.
Yeah.
And how dangerous the people that farm it and process it, like the danger they're exposed to.
Yeah. So point being, if you're a farmer out there, thank you. I mean, my God.
Hats off.
Seriously. Be careful out there.
Yeah. Sounds like there was a lot of improvements made after this. But yeah, I'm just like, the only thing I think of when you say that is that there has to be some way to make this safer, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, these explosions still happen. I mean, hopefully not at this scale, but they definitely still happen. So.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're working with a substance that flammable, it's like, it's going to happen. Mistakes are made. And like I said in the beginning, like, it's not just from a machine jamming and like causing a spark. It's also like if someone smokes a cigarette, like that you're then trusting the entire plant and whatever, everyone's lives in the hands of every single individual worker to like trust that they're not going to go have a smoke break and like flick their cigarette in the wrong place. Like,
yeah, right.
Spooky.
I mean, that's we have to institute a no cigarette rule at the grain plant.
No lighters on the premises, period. Like, Jesus.
It's like, hey, Jim, no Marlboros today.
Yeah.
Or ever.
Yeah, leave.
Stop it.
Maybe they'll adopt vaping. Don't do that either.
Yeah.
Like,
well,
geez.
I guess if you had to pick
between,
you know,
a massive explosion and vaping, I guess I would
choose
vaping.
We'll go with vaping.
Yeah, but
you
I
know?
Mean, hey,
or
that's...
you're in your truck. Stay in the truck.
Yeah.
Enclosed.
Yeah, hot box your truck.
Hot by your... hey, do that or no Nick, okay?
Yeah, yeah. Hey, the gum. Try the gum.
Do the Zin.
Oh.
I don't know.
We're not nicotine representatives. We do not want anyone to be on nicotine. You should get off of it
whatever,
if you're on it.
I mean,
do your
you
best.
Know,
you know?
Everyone has their vice.
Yeah.
But, you know, just don't blow up your plant.
Yeah.
Try.
The biggest takeaway, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway, I feel like we're rambling.
Well, yeah.
That's all I really have to say about that, I think. Why don't we close off with a bit of a palate cleanser and you can tell me your good thing. That way we can go back to our days as normal. What's your good thing?
Oh, you go first.
My good thing is that we're in the middle of like three shows right now that are all really good. And we're watching Severance, Yellow Jackets, and Bad Sisters, all of which are very good shows. So if you haven't seen any of those three, go give them a whirl. Two of them are on Apple. One of them's Hulu, I think.
Yes.
Anyway.
I agree. Yeah, Severance is my favorite.
Yeah, it's really good. I don't
so
know.
So good.
It's like weird and it's like you really never know what's going on, but it's a fun watch so far. So
yeah, it's such a unique premise. And then I don't know what you would call it. Is it the cinematography? Just like all the little details and how it's shot is so like sanitized and like eerie.
Yeah, it's super
good. Really good.
For those of you who don't know, Severance is like basically this company that puts a chip in people's brains that like turns off their brain when they're at work. So then when they leave work, they have no memory of what happens at work. It's like this. It's a whole thing. Go look into it. It's a good show. Anyway, that's my good thing. What's yours?
My good thing this week is that we have taught you euchre.
Oh.
And now I get to play euchre with you, which is fun because it's a fun game.
It's a card game for all you people who don't know what euchre is. Honestly, I didn't know what euchre was until I came to the Midwest. And when I saw my friends playing euchre for the first time, and really almost every time after that, it looks like they're playing a nonsense game. It looks like they're making it up as they go along and they're all in on the joke and everyone's just playing random cards and none of it makes sense and they're all just, you know, following each other's lead. It's not the case. It is actually a real game and I did learn it last night and now I can play the stupid game.
I think you're going to have fun with it.
Yeah,
it's a
I
good
probably
game.
Will.
You know, you get four people together. It's a good time.
Toss some cards.
But yeah, I know. I'm very excited that you know because I haven't played in a while. I was like, I forgot how fun it is. And yeah, it is absolutely a Midwest tradition.
It is nonsense.
So yeah, I know.
Crazy.
But it's like you really need to invest like 45 minutes to learn the full game.
Yeah.
And even on the top of that, everyone has their own little like tweak to the rules. Like, you know, have you ever played beer pong like in a different group of people?
Sure,
they're like,
that's
oh,
true. We play this rule.
We
it's
play,
like, okay,
yeah.
whatever.
Yeah, you just made this shit up.
Yeah, my friends last night were, as they were teaching me, they're like, okay, do you think she's ready for another rule? Should we throw another rule on there? Should we tell her this other secret rule? It's like, God, there are too many stupid rules to this game.
Well, that is the beauty of it. You gotta commit.
Whatever. Anyway, thank you so much for listening. If you would like to get access to a bunch of bonus episodes, check out patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. If you or anyone you know has a story of survival or something crazy that's happened to you and you'd like to share it with us and possibly hear it on an upcoming listeners episode, send it to notodaypodcast@gmail.com. We post pictures of all the stories we talk about over on Instagram @nottoday_podcast. We have a TikTok that is Not Today Podcast and a Twitter that is Not Today Podcast, but the T on the end of podcast is a 3.
Because that makes sense.
And just keep breathing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Riley Herbst from 2311 Racing here, and you know what grinds my gears? Waiting for coffee. But instead of counting frappes and lattes, I fire up Chumba Casino. No apps, no fuss, just fun social casino games to pass the time. By the time my coffee's ready,
order for Riley.
I've already taken a few victory laps. Next time you're stuck waiting, make it entertaining. Play for free at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.